dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few battle spaces more pressing in terms of the danger and in terms of the implications for the free world than Hong Kong at this moment. It is in perhaps the next few hours or days that we will watch Communist China play out its hand in terms of the next steps in repressing the people of Hong Kong and their courageous last stand, perhaps, in the face of that oppression. I am thrilled to be able to say we have with us for two segments a woman who has been courageously covering this story, often from Hong Kong, telling us what is happening, telling us who is doing what and why, and otherwise enabling us to appreciate with great clarity why it matters for us, not just for the people most immediately involved, whether Hong Kong is crushed by the Chinese Communist Party. Her name is Claudia Rosette. She is a highly acclaimed and award-winning investigative reporter who has covered beats like China and other totalitarian enterprises, notably the old Soviet Union, from their capitals, and done so with both, again, great clarity and great personal fortitude. She these days is a senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. She has been writing copiously about what's happening, most recently, I think, on the pages of the Dallas Morning News. And I had wanted to catch up with her to get an update about the weekend's particularly ominous developments, and I'm very pleased to be able to present her to you once again. Claudia Rosette, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
The cause of this call is a little less than great, I'm afraid, but give us your sort of current reading of what's happened just in the past 48 hours, for example, in the Polytechnic University campus and elsewhere in Hong Kong.
Well, I'll go back just a few days because what's been happening is China, by way of its China handpicked administration in Hong Kong, Chief Executive Carrie Lam, who never goes out to actually talk to these protesters, who's sort of this disembodied voice much of the time, just telling them they must calm down. There will be no negotiations until they stop protesting, which is really perverse. But the police have been, Hong Kong police, who are fronting for China, basically, at this point, and have become sort of the ruling factor in the streets of Hong Kong, have been attempting raids on the universities, which is where a lot of the so-called frontline protesters are. That's mainly the younger set. And there have been these sort of pitched battles between police and protesters at a number of these universities. And this reached the point at a university called Hong Kong Polytechnic, which is in Kowloon, not far from the Cross Harbor Tunnel, which has been another flashpoint because protesters have been blocking that over and over to call attention to their cause, which is freedom and democracy, actually. But this turned into this very fraught showdown where police surrounded Hong Kong Polytechnic. The protesters set fire to various things, including lobbing a Molotov cocktail at an armored truck that tried to come in. And this went on with police water cannon and then the police warning that they would use, if they needed to, they would use lethal force. Now, they've been using a lot of force for months, but lethal force, now we've ratcheted this up again. And this comes together with sort of right on the heels of a scene in which near a large, the China's army is garrisoned at a number of places around Hong Kong. And one of the big locations is near another university, Hong Kong Baptist University. And from there, where there had also been big protests, a number of PLA soldiers came out in T-shirts and shorts to clear barricades left by the protesters in the road. Now, that looks all very peaceful and nice. It isn't. For one thing, they have no business being out there. This is Hong Kong's affairs. Now you have China's army right there out on the street interfering. And it's also a very dire warning because, of course, these guys who look so pleasant and friendly in their T-shirts and shorts are there right back in there. They have guns. And these are, in fact, there had been reports that the designations on some of their T-shirts labeled them a special tactic. There were members of special tactical squads that are used for counterterrorism, which is one of the ways that China's government has been threatening the protesters, that they're calling them, basically labeling them terrorists, rioters, and so on.
The penalties for which are very, very high indeed, needless to say.
Yes, exactly. And you have step by step, this has escalated and escalated. Why is that happening? Because the protest, China and its chief, its puppet executive in Hong Kong, have given the protesters nothing. The only thing they've done that anyone could regard as a concession is in having introduced this terrible, reviled, hated, despised bill into the rubber stamp legislature that would have allowed for extradition to China, which is what sparked these protests, huge protests in June. And they've just kept going since. Carrie Lam, the chief executive, did not actually fully withdraw that bill until she finally reconvened an adjourned legislature in October. She announced in September she would withdraw it. But it had hung out there with the protesters demanding that it be withdrawn. And the longer that kind of stonewalling goes on by the government, the greater the reminder and message to the people of Hong Kong that if they don't have the ability to choose to elect their own chief executive, to elect their own, to fully elect their own legislature, they have no real defense. They don't even have that layer against China's dictates. They have what they have instead is a chief executive who first serves the interests of Beijing, a legislature such as it is, which is chronically rigged so that it chronically has a pro-Beijing majority. That's how the electoral system in Hong Kong works. Some people get more votes than others. There's a whole special interest set up
to ensure China's control. I mean, this is the bottom line. There's everything that you've just described, Claudia Rosette, is, of course, instruments for the purpose of assuring China's ability to dominate, control, and if necessary, punish those who are violating its will. And we're going to talk more after a short pause, Claudia Rosette, about a positive step, a positive sign. A few of them are to be found, but there is one, and I want to get your help in making sense of it. And then talking about what we can and should be doing at this moment to stand unmistakably for freedom and with the people of Hong Kong who aspire to it. That and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with Claudia Rosette, an extraordinarily courageous reporter and witness to events of our time, most recently and notably those taking place as we speak in Hong Kong. Claudia is, among other things, the author of The Rosette Report at PJ Media and is an investigative reporting fellow, a journalist fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, a dear friend and cherished resource for me and this program. And we're so appreciative for the time she gives us with considerable regularity. And Claudia, I did want to say there was this one rather remarkable thing that happened, and it caught me by surprise. I wondered if it did you. We'll be speaking a little bit more about it with Gordon Chang in a moment, but your take on the ruling by the High Court in Hong Kong to strike down one of Carrie Lam's edicts, namely that it is illegal to wear a face mask, which has been an important means of trying to enable people protesting what China is up to do so without putting themselves at great risk due to the sort of increasing surveillance state apparatus that China is bringing to bear, not only on the mainland, but in Hong Kong as well.
Yeah, well, bless the legacy of British rule of law, which is what part of what the which is what the protesters were effectively defending when in June they marched 2 million strong through the streets of Hong Kong. How exactly the administration will respond is an interesting question. And I don't know the exact answer. We'll see. But remember a couple of things. This ban on face masks has not actually stopped Hong Kong's people from using face masks. In fact, the first thing they did as it went into effect was protest in around the city wearing face masks. And then there were protests, some peaceful, some not violent, of people wearing face masks. It was this incredible defiance.
Some of them wore face masks that had the picture of Xi Jinping on them, as I recall. Is that right?
Yes. Halloween in Hong Kong was, by many accounts, one of the most interesting ever. But because where do you draw the line? But on a more serious note, this presents an interesting conundrum for the administration, which has been talking endlessly about rule of law. And one of the things I'd just call your attention to is there are two very different versions of what is meant by rule of law that are in direct conflict here. Rule of law, as we understand it, and as Hong Kong's people, they're a free society. You know, they don't have the institutions supporting them, but it is a free society. That's what we're seeing there, is a rule of impartial law made through a process that gives a fair hearing to people and develops sort of a body of law that lets you, gives you a real chance of justice. When China talks about rule of law, that's not what they're talking about at all. Rule of law is there is an edict issued, basically. The Communist Party tells you what you should do, and you do it. And if you don't, you're violating the rule of law.
Claudia, let me just interrupt to ask you a question. Speaking of the rule of law, one of the laws that was supposedly going to govern in Hong Kong for another few decades is the basic law that you referred to a moment ago. What are the chances that the court will take up the question of whether what the People's Liberation Army is doing, or seemingly is poised to do, building on this public works program that they engaged in the past few days, to actually bring violent, you know, capabilities to bear to suppress the demonstrations in Hong Kong, might they stand up and denounce that as illegal under that law as well?
Possibly. I don't know the sort of legal intricacies here, but I do know there's one very dangerous sort of nuclear trigger, and that is that it is possible under the basic law for, as China pointed out in the summer, for the chief executive to invite China to come in, to sort of step in and help with the, in an emergency with Hong Kong. And of course, the chief executive does what she's told. So if China wants her to invite them, I'm sure that will happen. That's the danger that could override all of this.
So, Claudia, you have written both about what's going on there and what's going on, or put differently, not going on here with regard to this idea of trying to help bolster the cause of the people of Hong Kong. Give us your flavor of this. You've written very powerfully about it in a piece in the Dallas Morning News recently in the context of the Berlin Wall Memorial, the celebration, I should say, of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the tearing down of that wall, and what it meant for the communist regime that you reported about so vividly from Moscow for many years. The lessons learned there. And again, speaking specifically, what we should be doing now to help the people who are on the front lines of freedom in Hong Kong.
Well, look, it's in America's interest. It's in the world's interest. It's even in the interest of the people of China that China should not be a totalitarian dictatorship run by a president for life who wants to be the world's dominant power. You know, that's very dangerous. That's a path to World War III. It's greatly in the interest of the world that China should be a free country. And there is, I would not invest huge hopes in this, but there's just that chance that what's happening in Hong Kong right now is something where people in China do get an idea. Beneath the great clouds of propaganda pumped out by the Communist Party, people are not fools, and they see. And that it could actually be the beginning of something that leads to enormous change. Again, you know, I would not bank on that. And I would remember in the run-up to the collapse of the Soviet Union, you saw the uprising crushed in Hungary, in Prague. You saw people shot. You saw terrible things go on in the prisons. It was a long, hellacious fight, basically. But there is that chance, and it is worth standing with the people of Hong Kong, as they keep asking us to do, in any ways we can. Going to war to defend Hong Kong, per se, I don't think any country is about to do. And if you did, Hong Kong is a small territory. Basically, the city would be destroyed in the course of defending it is the likely outcome. Okay. But in any way that pressure can be brought to bear on China to back off, to honor its treaty violation, its treaty promises, you know, that's a really important point. The U.S. and our allies from Japan to, as I keep saying, Japan to France, should be doing that. One immediate thing would be the U.S. Congress should pass, and President Trump should sign, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which is right now washing around in the Senate, because that is one way of bringing pressure to bear on China, which uses Hong Kong as its main foreign exchange window. The deal that China is offering Hong Kong's people, in effect, or not offering, is requiring them to accept at growing risk if they don't, is that Hong Kong may carry on with what I call the China deal as a sort of obedient serf state, allowed to make money, but not to say anything about politics or demand justice if the Communist Party chooses to withhold it. So sort of obediently work away, but don't think you have any dignity as human beings. That's China's deal. And Hong Kong is saying, no, that's something where it's very important we stand with that. That's the kind of thing, in the end, we fought for in World War II against that kind of edict and system. Frank, it's so hard to sort of stand up free societies where they have been crushed out of existence or don't exist or didn't exist. We have spent so much blood and treasure in places like the Middle East trying to get these things to function. In Hong Kong, which the British handed over to China in 97.
We were both there.
Yeah, exactly. There, this incredible free society has sort of grown up. It's there. They understand it. They understand the responsibilities. They are calling to the world, please support us in our fight for this freedom and democracy that they were promised when they were handed over to China. And I would say should be their rights as human beings anyway. And anything we can say or do to support them, we should do.
There's a lot of talk at the moment in Washington about somebody who's going by the name of Anonymous, who's published a book denouncing the Trump administration as an insider. The New York Times has reported that there's an Anonymous who has just dumped something like 400 different documents of internal memoranda of the Chinese Communist Party focused on their efforts to suppress the people of Xinjiang, the Uyghur Muslims specifically, but I think others there as well. I'm sure you've had a chance to examine what's been published so far. One of the things that has jumped out to me, and I'm sure to you as well, is how horrific this government of China is, that it would do this to its own people, this enslavement and gulags and so much more, imposing not least this this practice I'm told of having Han Chinese men who are put in occupation, basically, of the homes of people, men who've been put in those concentration camps, sleeping with their wives. I mean, it's hard to imagine the kind of brutality and repression that this regime is capable of, and yet it should inform what we're talking about.
A quick word of caution on that document dump. Be a little careful, because it's not verified. It's plausible, but be a little careful in assuming all of it's legitimate, because you don't want to have everything discredited if a piece of it isn't. So be careful, look for verification. But that said, what's been going on in China for decades has been horrific. Xinjiang is one of the latest horrible manifestations. But go back to Tiananmen, go back to Mao's Cultural Revolution, when children were turned around to inform on their parents and the literate were paraded as dunces through the street and rusticated to starve to death, to the deaths of tens of millions, scores of millions in China under that Communist Party, the same one that celebrated its 70th anniversary on October 1st of this year. This is what that system is.
Amen. Claudia, we have to go. Thank you so much for this, and I hope that you will return with updates to us very soon, and God bless you.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by our friend and colleague now of many years, I'm pleased to say, a regular featured guest of this program and one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving China. His name is, of course, Gordon Chang. You see him at Fox News, you read his writings in The Daily Beast and Fox.com and The National Interest and elsewhere. He is the author of three terrific books: The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. You can follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. And you can also follow him here, of course, and we're always pleased to do so. Gordon, it's a pleasure to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Frank.
We were just talking with Claudia Rosette about Hong Kong, and I know it's on your mind as well. Give us your take, Gordon, of what this attack on the Polytechnic University and the emergence of the People's Liberation Army on the streets of Hong Kong, albeit in the form of cleanup workers, what all this portends for the next steps there?
The troops from the People's Liberation Army that were cleaning up bricks in Kowloon Tong at Baptist University, that was a publicity stunt, but it was also, of course, a warning. And in some ways, it's a violation of the basic law which governs Hong Kong, because the PLA came on the streets not at the request of the Hong Kong government. And this is basically Beijing's way of saying that we're going to do what we want with our troops. Now, with regard to the standoff at Polytechnic University, the police are trying to clear the university. And the tactics that they are using show that they really don't want to actually just clear the buildings. They want to inflict pain on the protesters. We have seen them, for instance, use tear gas and rubber bullets on protesters who were trying to surrender. And there is now that famous video of a Hong Kong policeman stomping on the head of a protester who's prone on the road. So the Hong Kong police have shown that they have just lost control of all emotions, as we've seen over the course of the last several months. And just one other point, Frank, and that is all of this occurring in the run-up to the district council elections next Sunday, the 24th. Hong Kong government is now talking about postponing those elections. If they do that, I think that it would be a trigger for greater protests throughout society, not just the young kids clad in black, but also just general people, largely because right now this is what Beijing wants to do. It knows it's going to lose those elections, and it's going to be very, very difficult for them to continue if those elections, in fact, take place
and come out very badly for their point of view. Gordon Chang, let me turn to a not unrelated subject, but a different one, and that is this revelation of a cache of documents from inside the Chinese Communist Party that describes what the party has been doing in Xinjiang, the western provinces of China, where Muslim Uyghurs and others are being massively incarcerated. Tell us what you make of these documents and their import.
Well, the documents paint a picture of something that we have already known. The important point here, of course, is confirmation. And second of all, it says that there is disagreement in the Communist Party about its policies in Xinjiang, what the people there call Chinese occupied East Turkestan. So apparently Xi Jinping's hard policies are now encountering some pushback. And that's why we're seeing these documents. We've got to remember that what we have known and what these documents confirm is a genocidal campaign. It's a campaign to incarcerate people solely because of their religion or their ethnicity. This is a part of China's racist Han nationalism. And this is a warning to the rest of the world what the Chinese would do if they were in a position to govern other lands. So we've got to stop China. And this is an indication that we cannot allow any more spread of this Third Reich-like regime.
People have tended to suggest that comparisons to Hitlerian totalitarianism are overblown. But really what these documents suggest, Gordon, if anything, is that the comprehensiveness of the repression of the people of this particular region, but more generally the people of China, is at a level that Hitler could only have dreamed of in terms of things like this surveillance state apparatus and the so-called social credit score. How is that operating in Xinjiang and more generally, and to what effect do you think on the people they're affecting?
In that northwestern part of what the Chinese believe is their country, there is a level of control, which basically is martial law. And what you have is a lockdown of an entire area. You know, Frank, I know people complain about comparisons of the People's Republic of China to the Third Reich of Germany, but the only thing that's missing now is mass extermination. We know that people are dying in those camps. And we also know that the purpose of this is the extermination of racial and ethnic groups. Now, you know, China is involved in organ harvesting, which Hitler didn't do. We know that there are experiments on humans. There is this racist-based Han nationalism. There's territorial aggression, historical grievance. You have all the elements there. And so, therefore, people can say that at least prior to 1941 or so, the comparisons between Germany and China are really apt.
I wonder if one of the phrases that jumped out from a document in this trove that the New York Times has published, the organs of dictatorship, doesn't sound an awful lot like what, you know, the totalitarians of yesteryear, both nominally the fascists and the communists, utilized. And this is from internal documents of the Chinese Communist Party. So it's evidence of their understanding that these organs, these totalitarian tools, can be highly effective in oppressing and repressing the people against which they're brought to bear.
The Chinese, in those documents, use the term concentration camps. And that is something that, of course, you know, we can determine by just looking at what has occurred. But it's important that the Chinese officials view it the same way. And, you know, we're looking at a system which is not only in the northwestern part of the country, but it's also throughout. We're seeing the return to totalitarian social controls. You mentioned the social credit system. That will perhaps next year be nationwide, giving everybody a constantly updated score based on behaviors. Also, you have next year, they plan to have in place 626 million surveillance cameras. We are seeing all sorts of things that remind us of not authoritarianism, because China is often called authoritarian, but that's really out of date if it was ever in fact appropriate. What we're seeing right now is the return to full totalitarianism. And this is the way Chinese regimes in the past, the imperial regimes, have been totalitarian, so we shouldn't be surprised. And we should understand that this is what China would do to the rest of the world when it achieves its global ambitions, if that ever were to occur. So this is a regime that we have a stake in stopping now, because this is not just Uyghurs and Kazakhs in northwestern part of China. This is really China's plan for the planet.
It is indeed, and that ought to be of such surpassing importance to all of us that we come together in opposition to it. I've noticed that Elizabeth Warren has come out rather strongly in opposition to China. The president is, of course, still interested in securing some sort of trade deal, even a skinny one. Gordon, do you think one of the things that we ought to be putting on the table right away is that there is going to be no trade deal if this crackdown in Hong Kong that seems to be underway, to say nothing of the horrors that are being inflicted on the people in the western part of China, and more generally, for that matter, continue apace?
Yeah, there are so many reasons not to have a trade deal with China. And of course, the horror of Xinjiang East Turkestan is one of them. But also the other thing is that the Chinese don't honor their agreements with us. They have not honored any trade agreement with us. So why do we think that the remedy is going to be another deal? So you go down the list, Frank, there's just no reason to have a trade deal with China. Any short-term accommodation is not going to last. It's going to benefit them by giving them a reprieve at a very difficult time for them. So I don't think that we should have a trade deal with them, full stop.
Gordon, I'm struck by one other thing that we've talked about from time to time, and that is that you mentioned some 625 million cameras. I guess most of them are being manufactured by a company called Hikvision. And one of the things that we've uncovered in the Committee on the Present Danger, China, through the work of Roger Robinson primarily, is Americans are investing billions of dollars in companies like Hikvision in China that are enabling this domestic repression and what they have, as you say, for the rest of us. This is madness, and I pray that we will see it stop. Gordon, quickly, the South Korean government apparently prevailed upon ours to forego some joint air combat drills in the effort to get the North Koreans back to the table. What's going on there, and is this advisable either?
It's certainly not advisable, Frank. The North Koreans have continued with their massive winter training cycle and summer training cycle, and we have postponed our larger exercises with South Korea. So their readiness is high, and ours is eroding fast. This is wrong. The North Koreans want, they say, to have an agreement with the United States, but they're not acting in good faith. And, you know, this postponement of the air drills is supposed to create this favorable environment for talks. Talks right now are not what's going to solve this. The only thing that's going to solve this are tough American policies, including the vigorous enforcement of sanctions and the resumption of all military exercises.
Gordon Chang, thank you for your time today, as always, and keep up the good work. Come back to us again next week, if you will.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is beyond a delight. It is a privilege to say that we are joined by Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor who you frequently see at Fox News and read, I hope, at places like the National Review, or perhaps in his myriad extraordinarily important books, most of them very, very highly acclaimed bestsellers, including a personal favorite of mine, The Grand Jihad. Andy McCarthy, it's been too long. We're very pleased to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, my friend, it's always a pleasure.
You've been doing, as usual, indispensable work, Andy, helping to make sense of, to the extent one can, what's going on with this effort to impeach the President of the United States. You've had a week's worth of hearings now, another week heading up in the days to come. Tell us what you make of what we saw last week, and what does your crystal ball suggest is likely to be on display in the days ahead?
Frank, I think the bottom line is that this impeachment push is precisely the abuse that the framers had in mind when they put the impeachment clause in the Constitution. they understood that because the powers of the presidency they were creating, which were necessary for the defense of the country, were so awesome that if the powers fell into the hands of a rogue president, that could be ruinous for the country. So they understood that an impeachment remedy would, as Madison put it, be indispensable to our structure of government. You had to have a way to get, if you could contemplate that kind of a president, you would had to have a way to remove the president. But they tried to make clear that impeachment should only be invoked in really extraordinarily serious cases. In a republic based on self-determination and liberty, the idea is that the electorate, not the political class, decides who is president and whether the president gets to keep the job. And the idea was that the political class should only intervene and move to remove a president on misconduct of the nature of, for example, what they mention in the Constitution is treason, bribery, which was not at the time, we were not talking about a federal bribery statute, which has a lot of technical conduct that is branded bribery, but is not exactly the bribery that the framers had in mind, which was the fear that a foreign power could basically purchase the president in a so that it was traitorous in the same nature that treason is traitorous. And then what the framers said was besides treason and bribery, the only other reason for removing a president was other high crimes and misdemeanors. And that word other is very important because it underscores that high crimes and misdemeanors have to be of a nature as serious as something like treason. So that's the kind of extraordinary, egregious misconduct we're talking about. And they didn't think, Frank, that it was enough to make it a high bar in a definitional sense. They also politically undertook to make it really hard to do. They did that by essentially giving it to the political branches. So this is a political issue, not a legal one. And they made it so that a president could not be removed without a two-thirds supermajority vote by the Senate, which means unless you have conduct that is so egregious that a consensus in the country develops that the president must be removed such that it will move two-thirds of the Senate, despite partisan and ideological ties and divides, to the conclusion that the president needs to be removed. And unless you have that, no president will ever be removed. And look, we've been around for nearly a quarter of a millennium, and no president has been removed under this process.
Andy, when you look at what's happened, and specifically the course of the hearings last week, which presumably was the best shot that Adam Schiff and the Democrats were going to be able to muster here, you said it fell flat. My word would be for a bust, rather. But whatever one calls it, it certainly fell far short of, well, even really defining the impeachable offense here. You mentioned bribery, and this is a term that's now being bandied about. What evidence have they demonstrated for bribery of any kind, let alone of the very high bar kind you talked about?
Yeah, Frank, you raise a couple of really important points. The first is that this has been a project which has been groping for a legal hook from the beginning. So bribery seems to be where they've landed. But, you know, they started out with campaign finance violations, and then they thought about extortion. Extortion is a domestic law enforcement concept that has no bearing on foreign relations. For example, just taking Ukraine out of it, our government is currently trying to squeeze the Iranians into a better deal, a better deal than Obama's nuclear pact, which is happily mostly consigned to the dustbin of history. But the point there is that, of course, we want our president to be able to coerce other countries into doing things that are in American interest. So extortion is not something, this is what pressure is what other countries put on each other. They either cajole each other into cooperation, or they try to coerce each other by using pressure. In fact, I think most people would think extortion was probably better than war. But in any event, it's not a concept that fits here. So now they've settled on bribery. And the thing they like about bribery, Frank, is that, number one, it's, as we just mentioned, it's explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. And number two, there is a federal bribery statute, which, of course, didn't exist at the time the Constitution was adopted in 1787. And we didn't have federal law enforcement like we have it today. But there's a federal bribery statute that doesn't require a completed bribe in order to have a bribery crime. What the federal bribery statute says is that you need a corrupt demand where a public official says, I won't do these official acts that you need me to do unless you do something for me. And the something for me, the quid pro quo, is the bribe. So they want the public to see this in terms of the federal bribery statute. The problem they have with that is twofold. Number one, the federal bribery statute is not the bribery that the Constitution is talking about, which was the framers' fear that a president would essentially be purchased by a foreign power to do the bidding of the foreign power rather than the American people. And secondly, even if the federal bribery statute applied, that is, even if this were a legal proceeding rather than a political proceeding, they still would not be able to prove corrupt intent beyond a reasonable doubt, because the statute that allows the president to transmit defense funding to Ukraine requires the executive branch to ensure that the Ukrainians are rooting out corruption. So if the president asked for investigations in a way that he could have been intending, or that could be easily understood as an effort to root out corruption, even if it happened to be beneficial to him politically, that was something that the law would allow him to do. So I don't see how you could prove corrupt intent under the circumstances.
Yeah. This is such important work, Andy, and again, I commend you for all of it. But I wanted just to tie it back to something that you've, of course, published recently entitled Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. This is, depending on who's counting, the fourth or fifth sort of iteration of this conspiracy or this coup, if you will. You've pointed out, Andy, that at the end of the day, at least as a result of the first week of testimony, what pretty clearly is operating here is not so much impeachable offenses as policy differences. And this is hardly the means by which the framers envisioned us sorting out policy differences, isn't it?
Yeah. I think, Frank, that the framers would have been somewhat stunned by the existence of what the witnesses that the Democrats have called from, for example, the National Security Council are pleased to call the policy community. Their idea was that we had an elected official who was in the president, who was in charge of making policy. And that was the only way in a self-determining republic that you had the political official in charge of making foreign policy was accountable to the voters, not to the bureaucracy. So the idea that these guys seem to have is that the government is running the president, not the other way around. So I think it's been useful, especially since the president is not going to be removed from office. I mean, that's obvious enough. But I think it's been a useful exercise for the public to see that, much like we saw in the Mueller investigation, where you have a lot of intelligence and law enforcement officials who think that they are supposed to be completely independent of political supervision by the elected leaders of the executive branch, so too in the foreign policy realm, you have an extensive policy bureaucracy that thinks the president's job is to carry out their memoranda that they busily prepare.
Andy McCarthy, thank you for clarifying these very important issues, and I hope that we'll be able to consult with you after this week's proceedings and that they will be no more materially consequential than the previous week. Thank you, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.